Hey everyone, welcome back to the Talking Split podcast. We are in for episode 7 of season 2.
Beautiful.
Mike, early. This is straight unusual. Normally we have to prompt him to get some interaction out of him. We do have the high performance coaches for Metro and Country, Justin Shaw and Mike Zeppel, in the room with us.
Robbie, how are you, mate?
Excellent, thank you. You can download the episode on iTunes, Audio Boom, the BV website. If you can, please leave a rating and review and share and retweet the podcast and try and grow the audience a little bit. Not so much because we're seeking fame and fortune, because this may shock you guys, but we don't make a lot of money off podcasting. But more so that we can continue the conversation as much as we can. So
we do have heads for podcasting, though.
We certainly do. The TV show that we're pitching for season 3 may go poorly, but we'll see how that plays out. Do use the hashtag Talking Split, though, if you're on Twitter, and we'll pick up all your tweets from there. Our topic for this week, 21 keys to win basketball games. So this can apply to all levels of basketball, domestic all the way through to senior level. We did come up with with 7 each, I suppose. We did have a little bit of crossover in a few of them, so there might be a little bit of
discussion
about a couple of them.
Banter.
Some of them we disagree with, that are some of the others, which is okay as well. These will not necessarily work every time, but they might just be something that you might not have been aware of, or something that you can potentially try with your athletes as well.
For the audience, like, we all three of us went away and we said, look, we'll do 21, have 7 each. Like, what do you value? What do you think adds up to a W at the end of the day? Come back together and see, you know, what we've got. It doesn't work for every system, every philosophy, but, you know, what we've got certainly are things that people can address at some point in their coaching.
I think the other thing is we've all looked at it slightly from a different angle, which is coaching. Like, that'll come out in the pod, but everyone's got a little different thought on, you know, what really matters, and that's a good thing.
Yep, definitely. All right, who wants to kick off?
I will, Robbie.
Excellent.
I will, Zep. Robbie.
Jeez, this is a proactive Zep.
Number one.
He's got a new haircut. So
that's it, mate. That's it. I'll start off with number one. A little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it'll just allow me to get on my high horse real quickly before we talk about the other 20 things, which they don't matter unless you have good basketball players on the floor. So number one for me was, tongue-in-cheek, have the best player on the floor. What that really means is you've got to value player development. Like, if you're going to coach an under-14 team, an under-16 team, a domestic team, your players have to get better. If you do have the best player on the floor, the statistics around actually winning that game would be significantly high.
Especially the younger the age group.
Correct.
If you've got the best player on the floor, the better chance you've got of winning.
Correct. So I think, just as a coach, I value player development. People that know me know that I value player development and kids getting better and coaches getting better at their craft too. So I think just keeping in mind that with all the stuff we're about to talk about, and we're going to talk about different nuances of the game, you've got to continue developing your players and developing yourself as a coach. So, number one, development.
Not play your best player.
He'll be on the floor, or she will be on the floor if she is the best player, Robbie. So, just for the audience, keep in mind that we'll speak about a lot of things right now, but player development and coach development is huge.
It's interesting you came to us with this one, given you were the best player on your Werribee team as a junior.
And kept getting benched for bad shots. So moving right along, I'll take the next one. So for me, it is absolutely owning the three-point game. And that it fleshes out a little bit. You've heard me talk about it before. But as a team, you need to win the transition point game. So that means having great defensive transition, not giving them points in that element, keeping them off the foul line. So this all comes into your practice environment. Drilling, not, you know, keeping hands out, not hacking away as they go on a drive, vertical contests, and the last one, second chance points. So making sure that there is boxing out in your practice plans, and you're limiting how many chances they get at it. If your team can be great in those three areas and then flip it, you're great going the other way, that's definitely going to be one step towards having a successful program.
Yeah, I like it. All right, mine is timeout usage. One of the first things I was told as a coach is, do not help the other coach. So when the ball is on the baseline and it is their ball, do not be blowing that timeout to allow the coach down the other end to draw up a play. And similarly, if clock winding down, you know the other coach is out of timeouts, don't be blowing a timeout to help the other team. So it's understanding the game of runs and when you need to blow those. I know I'm a if anyone had seen me coach, you'd probably be one, appalled, but two, you'd potentially sit there and say, this guy never blows timeouts, and I try and save my timeouts as best I can, and I'm really big on letting the players work through problems. And don't get me wrong, if it needs to be blown, I'm happy to blow it, but I try and not use timeouts if I can manage it.
That, so, to me, matters in that you've got to understand why you want to use timeouts, not just blow a timeout because 5 minutes has gone in the quarter and I better say something to my team. Also understanding the other ways and times you can communicate to your team without using a timeout, you know, like foul shots on, get a, you know, signal to your point guard or whoever it is that passes on messages. Any stoppage in the play is a chance to communicate. The biggest challenge I see for coaches is when the pressure goes up and understanding the rules of the game as to when timeouts are in play or not. Yep. Like, you lose a timeout once that thing ticks over 2 minutes. I've seen many coaches muck up games because they're saving them for that and now one's gone anyway. So having a plan in place, I think, is pretty important.
Just on that, are you guys big on advancing the ball in that last 2 minutes? Like, and blowing that time out to advance it? Because I know previously I was really big on it, and just sort of coaching over the last year and a half or so, I've actually been a little bit more don't blow it unless you have 2 seconds and you have to get a shot away, just because it gives more space.
I think, yeah, know your team. If your team's really good in the half court, then yeah, get the ball in the half court. If your team's really good at up the floor, if they're a really good punch screen team, if they're, you know, if that's more their style and where they're going to find success, I think that's also what you're thinking about.
I also think it's about how much time you get with your team. Like, if you have been able to spend a lot of time on situationals and your team knows exactly what you need to get done, that kind of matters. And sometimes you don't need to. And sometimes if you have all your timeouts gone, but your team's that well versed, well, away you go. I think that's a game by game scenario, that part.
Hey, calling timeouts, it's something that you do get better with the longer you coach too, and the more situations and scenarios you find yourself in. And I just think the more games you coach, the more high level games, as you work, you know, we might be talking under 12s and the 14 VJBL coaches, as you get better at it and find yourself in meaningful games, a lot of the time it becomes a gut instinct thing, like, yeah, we need to talk about this.
Well, I guess I'll jump on the next point then, because this is one of the ones that we're kind of talking about, is know who you are. And that's, you know, are you a team that's great in execution in the half court? Are you a team that plays fantastic in pace? You know, like, we're playing the Sixers this, you know, in the grand final, they're all about transition, so I'm pretty sure Joey would want that from the end line so we can play with some pace. But also, don't be a three-point shooting team if your kids can't throw it in the ocean. You know, like, figure out a system that works for you. And I think it's really important to understand, well, there's two ways you can go with that. You can recruit to go with the system that you know and can play inside out, or you need to be able to adapt as a coach to what athletes you get. Now, depending what level you're coaching determines, well, are you recruiting or are you inheriting? Now, that's going to determine it. But knowing who you are as a group, I think, is something that is often forgotten about, and the earlier everyone understands that, the better your win-loss record becomes.
Yeah, and I like to answer and ask the question, like, how are you actually going to win the game? Like, what does the game look like? Because I think the really good teams, when they win the game, it looks the same week to week. They don't win one game one way and then win a game a completely different way. There are different games. Like, you know, one night you won't shoot it so good. But I think the way they win, when Adelaide win this year, that game is up and down. It's chaos. I'm not talking about this stuff, regular season stuff. When they won these games, they look the same. I mean, the film looks the same.
It's points in transition, they got to the foul line, so they're disrupted.
I think it's a really good point to figure out how you're going to win games, and does that suit your personality and your personnel? Yep. Number five, we're up to number five now. Okay, Robbie.
Is that correct, Matt?
Yeah, it is.
Okay,
fine. Come on, Robbie. Number five, you need a go-to set or a go-to quick hitter that your squad knows can get you a clean look at the end of the game when you need it. So, tied ball game, 45 seconds to go. You've got the ball. What is your go-to play? What's your pet play, the one that your team, that version of that team, can run with great success to get a clean look? Now, Sometimes it'll go in, sometimes it won't, but you want to give yourself the best chance to make a play down the stretch. Is that a catch and shoot for your best shooter? Is it a catch and rip for your best athlete? Is it a post touch for your best post interior player? I think having a go-to or a pet play, something that the kids know, okay, we're running black right now, that they know exactly where to go on the floor, who to screen, who the play's for, so you get a clean look.
The other part to that, though, is know the counters on it as well, because if that's your go-to and you come up against someone that knows that's your go-to, versing the athletes in understanding, well, if they switch out on that, what do we do? So, yeah, all the intricacies that can come with that.
You've hijacked my number six very nicely there, mate. That's what we want. So
this mine is working better than we thought.
It's flowing almost. So rather than draw up something completely different, try tweaking something you already have. So if you have run that pet play or counter three or four times in the game, understand the other team is probably going to be aware of that by now, especially if it's been successful. So if you do have that timeout and you have to go and draw something up, rather than draw up something completely different that the players may never have seen before and you have to make up on the fly and have them understanding on the fly, just a little wrinkle. Hey, they're probably going to deny this. Why don't we try back cutting this? Or if they switch that out, look at the slip.
Yep.
Or double or set up a line the same way, but then go and do something different.
Every great coach that you hear talk about the pressure situations will often refer back to the clarity that needs to come around when pressure is on. And I think the more you can tweak what you know, the better the clarity can be in those moments where it really matters. And I think that's a great point, Rob.
Yeah, so just what were those again, Robbie? So the doubling, that's a clear one. So what happens if we get doubled? Yep. What happens if we
face a denial.
Yep. A switch, okay, so we run a handoff right here, but they switch it or they switch this on ball. What now? Zone. And what happens if they zone? I mean, they're all things that you can definitely take into account with that pet play.
Yep.
And a lot of offense, you see the really good offensive coaches, they have little triggers. If this happens, then this is what happens next. I think that's a really good point.
So we've been talking a lot of offense. So to me, the number one thing that you need to have in any team if you're going to have any success is D-Train's rules.
Number seven,
D-Train's rules. You know, like, are you a team that's going to send five to the glass and that helps build your D-Trans from there? Are you a three back and two to the glass? Whatever it is, but having that system in place so that your athletes know on the rise of the shot what's next. The teams, and how often you'll see, you know, five kids below the foul line if you're not tagging up and crashing, and that ball gets over the top and it's a layup the other end. You know, understanding that, and then I guess even take it a little bit further back, understanding your shot balance is the start of your D-trans.
Yep.
So knowing where your shots come from, know where you need to get to on the floor from a defensive transition point of view, and then go from there. I think that's number one thing in practice, is understanding that.
And you hit on that really well. I think it's your D-trans does start from the shot. It's, and shot selection is a part of that. If you're just kicking up shots whenever you feel the urge, well, no one's going to have any idea on who's responsible for safety, who's on the boards, anything like that. It's a real problem. Understanding if, you know, D-trans matters. It can save you a lot of points. Long shots equals long rebounds.
Yeah.
And you've got to adjust your D-trans because of that. And you bang on. Saving points is just as valuable as scoring points.
Yeah.
I think it's overlooked.
I think some of these things will be similar, but that comes back to who are you?
Yep.
You know, like, are you the team that needs to send five people to the glass because you've got the best athletes on the floor? Or are you a team that needs to send five guys back because you are slow as anything? You know, like, whatever it may be, but knowing that is going to be pretty important.
I think it's the hardest thing to teach. Like, defensive transition, in my opinion, is the hardest thing to teach young athletes and older athletes to do. I just think it's so difficult. There's so many variances in it. Ball pickup, where's the ball, middle of the floor, sideline, who's the athlete. I think it's really hard to teach. I think it's absolutely starts with a mindset. Like, it has to be something that's drilled into your team, into your coaching staff, that we value defensive transition, because the first thing to go when your team falls apart is defensive transition.
Absolutely.
It's the first thing that goes. And I just think it's very much a mindset thing. And you know, if we believe in it, and if that's a part of what we're going to do, then we have to value it.
Yep. Number eight, you want that too?
I'll take number eight. We'll stay defensive.
Good.
We'll stay defensive. So Shula was a very good post player back in his day.
I'm not sure he knew where the paint was.
There you go. That's
post player from the three-point line.
That is one of the great handballs ever. allergic to the paint, sure. So what happens if you do play against a good team with a good post player? It could be a tall post player, a short post player. I'm more so concerned about a really good operator out of the post. What happens? And I think it's important that you do have a post trapping scheme of some description. I've seen it a few different ways. You can trap from the strong side wing, you can trap from the second man removed, you can trap from the opposite block. I think teams will, they don't have to run it every game because you won't play against the dominant post play every game, but having something that you know that you can use on a Friday night, on a Saturday night, just in case the other team does have a post player that is getting off on you, is really important. So I think that just helps the ball get out of the post. Dick Bennett, great coach from the US, pack line originator, said that coaches directly control defensive transition and post play. Like, they're the two things that, you know, you have direct influence over. So I think a post trapping scheme, Robbie, is very handy.
Very, and it's a way to use it as a massive advantage for your own team. Like, you can score them into a great scoring opportunity if you can turn the ball over to the post. Like, you're limiting what they can do, but you're scoring yourself.
I think coaches forget it's a great disruption point.
Great disruption.
Like, often we're talking about, you know, what we do in the full court or on a ball screen, whatever, but what you do on the post can be almost the best disruption point you can have.
Well, it's kind of the same principle as trapping a ball screen, in that it keeps your team in a really aggressive frame of mind.
Yep.
So they're constantly on edge, they're aggressive, they're not just letting the ball move where it wants to move. They're going to dictate where the ball goes, and we'll do that by trapping from either the backside post or the second man removed. So I think it's a good one to have in the back pocket, Robbie.
Absolutely. One of the things I do like to use in trapping the post is not go until the bounce. I see a lot of teams that will double down on the post straight away. Ball gets in there and they go straight away. It's one of the things I like to use is just wait till they've dribbled it and then go get it. Because most bigs, and that's a gross generalisation here, are not overly adept at putting the ball on the floor, making a read and seeing what else is going on around them.
I'm sometimes the other way, though, where if I know that post player is dominant but they're not the greatest passer, speeding them up is the best thing I think we can do. So just the second they catch it, they're seeing bodies, hopefully they're throwing that thing out high and wide and we can go at it. So I agree with you. I think sometimes there's got to be, you got to wait, but to me sometimes you just got to go and get it out of the danger area.
That's what happened last week. I watched BYU beat St. Mary's, and Jock Landau played well, but it definitely disrupted his rhythm.
Yeah.
And I don't know if the plan was to go on the bounce or on the catch, but what it did was get the ball out of the best player on the floor's hands and made someone else beat them. So it's interesting.
Come on, Robbie, give us something, mate. You've been sitting back, not giving us anything.
Wow.
That's
rough.
Number nine,
number
Robbie.
Nine. Practice game situations at training sessions. So I'm talking situational. So you might be down by two with 3 seconds to go, up by four with a minute to go, and you've got to try and hold on to the lead in different situations within. If you're just going to roll out in a game and hope that your players can work it out, you are hamstringing your players straight away. Like, you need to give them an opportunity to, one, understand time and score,
yep,
and you can do that at training sessions. And you might decide, like, I know, Justin, you've spoken about this a couple of times, where you'll run a situational to start the scrimmage,
yep,
and then you'll put 5 minutes on the clock out of that. So
yep,
you'll say, put, you know, 5 minutes 02.
Yep.
Do your 2 second situational, and then it's just normal scrimmage from there. So if you are time poor, there are different ways you can do this.
The other thing we'll always do is, it's twos and threes in practice always. We play the clock out always, because then situationals naturally occur.
Yep.
Our athletes understand when we are going 2-for-1. That's a default, like we always will, unless from a coach call it's not understanding, you know, what it means for us at certain times from a fouling situation. All those sorts of things, I actually like putting that in through your practice. So if you're, you know, 5 minutes on the clock, it's twos and threes game, that last minute becomes a situational, even though you're not just saying today's a situational practice. So, but there are definitely times where, at least, you know, every third week, I think you need to have some time on that, because it's always coming up. And the game is won and lost, really, in the last minute. You know, like, there's not too many games at a high end that are won in the first quarter. It's going to be in the down the stretch of the fourth quarter. How do your athletes handle time and score?
So that's, yeah, you just said it. Time and score is what coaches preach all the time.
Yeah.
So the athletes have to recognize that before it comes to a minute to go on Friday night. So building it into your practice, I think that's a great way to do it. You know, if you do have 16 seconds on the clock and you inbound the ball, then you've got 16 seconds to figure this out. And I think it just becomes organically it just grows in your athletes over time.
And you can do that as well. You don't necessarily need to prescribe that to your players. Sometimes you may just sit there and just off the cuff, just go, right, 5 seconds to go, that team has the ball, go and work it out, and not give them a timeout or not give them time to work it out. And you get to find out which players think a little bit on the fly, which ones are a little bit crafty, which players you may not want on the floor at the end of training sessions. I know Steve Kerr spoke about it when he was playing for the Spurs. He was such a situational player, he didn't do a lot of training while he was there. They just used to talk to the coach on the sideline, and all of a sudden the coach would go, and he'd have to find a spot on the three-point line. They'd pitch him a ball, and he just had to make the shot.
Read that. That's pretty cool.
That in itself is a situation where you can practice with your players.
I think he was even sitting down, on the sideline, just watching practice, and all of a sudden, you got to go in and knock this shot down. The other part is in your drill. Say if you're doing, say, three-way, where you have a three-possession game, you can start it from the baseline. Started from a baseline end line.
Against the zone.
And a lot of that can be predicated on scout, you know, who you're facing on the weekend. But if you want to get better at baseline end line plays, guess what? You've got to practice them as well. So,
number 10, huh?
Number 10.
So I'm torn as to which one to go next, but I do think this is kind of vital because I think if you don't have this, you're going to definitely put yourself in a losing position.
Why I made your list, mate.
So press breaker. You absolutely need to have a press breaker.
My language in number 12.
The one thing teams can change against you is come and trap and blitz and, you know, put the pressure in the backcourt. You need to have a well-organized press breaker. Your athletes need to understand the why around where the ball needs to go in the press breaker, not just run it, and then they're still going out like a bat out of hell down and going into trap zones. So making that be part of your practice. And for me, one thing I love doing is that's how we start warm-up. So we'll get through our press breaker as a shooting drill and, you know, five ends done. So they get in a situation on that. The other thing with press breaker is I hate when it's done without anyone on the floor. So to me, when we do it in warm-up, coaches will be out on the floor, you know, like one coach at the foul line, two at the halfway, and just taking up space. So now as the athletes are coming down the floor, they're seeing a different angle, a little bit more of a game-like angle. Press breaker, an absolute must.
I love your point of the why on that, because there's no point having a press break that works really well against a 2-2-1, but is terrible against a 1-2-1-1. But your players need to understand space. You need to have a press break that works for both. There's no point having three different press breaks. That's not an efficient use of your time as a coach, I don't think.
I think we've spoken about this, cues from the sideline. So I know a lot of the time coaches, and I played for them and I've done it myself, you know, you want to beat the press and score against the press, so they stop running the press. So then you start saying, go, 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 go. And all of a sudden, little Johnny is sped up, dribbles into a trap, and then you yell at him for turning the ball over. So your cues when breaking the press, what you're actually trying to, and how you want to beat the press is really important, especially when you're coaching junior athletes.
I think mindset on that is really important as well, though. Like
scoring chance.
It's absolutely a chance to create an advantage for us.
Mm.
So if they're trying to get after us, well, you know, put the resistance the other way and getting that mindset right on that, beating it with a pass versus a dribble, like they're trying to get you to dribble into areas, using the ball movement better, all those sorts of things I think are pretty important.
Robbie, back when I played a couple of moons ago, we would break the press at practice 5-on-7. Seven defenders on the floor, and you would break the press that way. And it's not so much to take away every conceivable option, but just challenge your passing, challenge your vision, and make sure that you can make some decisions against a little bit.
11, let's use it.
I'll go back to the post, Robbie. So we talked about Shuler and the post defense.
A little guy that never threw it in there.
We said that didn't have size wasn't the dictator of who was good in the post, Robbie. It was just ability. So when Shuler did get the ball in the post, I hope his coaches had a plan for what happened when there was an offensive post touch. So ball hits the post, ball's being fed, what now? We can't have four people standing around watching the ball. Just got to have a plan. And I think a consistent, especially when you're dealing with juniors, if we have one way of operating offensively once the ball goes in, now that can be ball in, Laker cut and relocate. It can be post-entry, screen away, you know, screen and split, or, you know, slip the screen. What happens when the ball comes back out of the post? What are we doing now? So I just think a plan for when the ball does go to the post, because I still think the ball has to go inside out, penetration or post feed, that at least we've got something in play that we can practice. At practice, you can do 3-on-0 shooting drills out of it. Like, there's ways to teach it, but I think a plan is really critical.
Well, the important part with that is the game is a game of opposites. So if we're working on how can we blitz the post, you definitely need a plan for when you're throwing it in and you see something coming at you, and you've got to have those opposites throughout the entire game.
Yeah. And it's important your players know how to throw it in the post. I mean, we probably see a lot now that a lot of bigs will step out a little further, and we don't necessarily get to play with post targets a lot, so having the ability to teach your kids how to throw it into the post and then move off that is a little bit of a lost art, I think. It's, they need to get better at it, and the only way they get better at it is practice.
Yeah, absolutely.
My point from before.
Peace. It's all coming time together, Robbie. All coming together.
Yeah, I like to think so. I'm wrong, but I like to think so. Number 12 is mine. So have a good assistant coach. So there are some people that are very good assistants but bad head coaches. There are some people that are fantastic head coaches but very bad assistants, and that's fine. But find someone that you can trust, that you can work with, and work with them to find out what their role is. I'm a big believer in, as a head coach, it's your job to develop your assistant coach. And in fairness, some assistant coaches may just be, hey, I'm happy to turn up and just take stats, and I'll sit here, and if you can't make it, well, I'm happy to give you a chop out, which is cool too. But it is really important to have an assistant coach and work with them on what their role is. If you just dictate and say, hey, you're on defense, and away you go with it, that's probably not going to help that coach a whole lot. For mine, it's really important that we sit there and say, well, okay, what are you good at? What are you not so good at? How can we help you develop that as well? Because it's not just about coaching your players. I think it's about helping other coaches progress as well. And if you've got a coach that you can trust that's assisting you, that'll go a long way towards your team culture, but also having a really good environment for your players to play in.
I think you hit it on the head. It's part of helping development, you know, definitely putting time into your assistant and not just letting them stand there along for the ride. Value their thought and give them as much idea around, make them think as a head coach. Like, I think that's the best assistant, is the one that's trying to see the game in that light. So having meaningful roles, if they're offering stuff, getting, you know, every once in a while just use that stuff. You know, you may not think it's right, but they're seeing it with a set of eyes. Maybe it turns out to be a positive for you. So no, definitely having a meaningful role there.
Consistency of message is the big one there. So the message from the head coach and the assistant has to align up. It has to be the same message. And then your point around developing your assistants, I mean, they talk about coaching trees and who coached with who, or, you know, who started coaching for who. I mean,
that's a couple of weeks.
Correct. I mean, it's such a big thing when you look at who people have worked for in the past. So I think that's a really good indicator of leadership and people that can develop other coaches to be really good coaches.
Yep. I'll go next. Ball screen D. So for a long time now, with state teams in particular, I've always spoken to our coaches about, got to be great in D-trans, got to be great with your ball screen D. Internationally, the amount of ball screen play is huge. It's trickling down more and more into all levels of the game. Just having a plan, understanding what we want to do when the screen comes from above the foul line, below the foul line, in the middle cylinder, on the sideline, and then you drill on that almost weekly, if not every practice, because it is the number one thing that a team can pick you apart on if you're not great at it.
Absolutely. And if I think that transition D is the hardest thing to teach athletes of all ages, I think ball screen defense is not far behind it, because it is really, really difficult. Again, it's a mindset thing. If the guard has it fixed in his mind or her mind that she's just not going to melt into the screen and get screened, that starts. If you have guards that are willing to get screened and, you know, just going to melt into the screen or take the contact, then it makes it very difficult. So the plan's the plan, and the plan's got to be a good one, but the mindset in we are going to defend ball screens has to kick it all off.
Yep. And I'm really big on, I like to run a lot of on-ball screens early in the game just to find out what the other team's doing as well. I think it can be a really good teaching point. If I see a team that's really good at hard showing off an on-ball, I probably won't hard show against them, because that's obviously something they practice and they see it at training. Yep. So it goes the other way as well. I think you're on, Mike. 14.
What number is this? 14, Robbie? All right, we won't pick on Shula for this one. But
probably means it's coming in my direction.
You're next, mate. You are next in the firing line. Coach the block out or coach the foul shot block out from two ways. So defensively, how are we going to box out or block out? Are we going to pinch? Are we going to cross? You know, make sure that we're not giving away free possessions from a simple missed free throw that bobbles on the rim. So you have to take care of the simple things like that. You'd hate to lose a game on a missed block out free throw, Robbie. Also, offensively, what happens if you're down two, down three, and you've got free throws with 5 seconds to go? How are you going to coach the offensive block out now? Do you coach the miss and the back tip to half court and try and get a late desperation three? I think that's just really important.
Last year or this season with Oklahoma?
Yeah.
I think Westbrook and Adams had something there.
Yeah.
Just kicked it back. And
I mean, you use it maybe once a season. But if you have a plan for it, I think just as long as you've got a contingency for the situation, just so you know what's happening. So I think it's like the jump ball. Like it happens often in the game, but we probably don't talk about it a lot, and that's because it's a very small part of the game. But just having a plan for blockouts is key.
Again, it can be the point of difference between a win and a loss.
Yeah.
Like if you gain an extra O-board because you're crossing and screening for each other on that, well then, great, that's a worthwhile
possession.
Thing. Like anything that's worthwhile and helps you win should be something you're looking at. The other one for me is boxing the elbows.
Yeah.
Like the amount of times those guards are sitting at the top there and just not engaged in what's happening on the free throw line.
Leaking out
and not taking care of that. Like boxing that elbow and just making sure we come up with it.
Yeah.
Good one, Zappelli.
15. You must know the foul count and the timeout situation. Like, any time a timeout happens, the first thing you should look at is scoreboard. Find out what the time, what the score is. Can we foul? Can we not foul? Do they have timeouts? Do they not have timeouts? The amount of times I've seen someone go, hey, let's just defend this straight up when they actually had fouls to give that could have saved them a game. You have to be across what the foul count is, what's bonus, what isn't.
Absolutely, but this comes back to you need to drill that stuff as well because...
At training,
because right back there, Robbie, because there's too many times where you hear someone yelling out foul, 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 and the kid just does the wrong thing, bear hugs them, and now it's in a worse situation. Like, understanding we want to foul on the bounce, we want to make a play at the ball, those sorts of things. But then also, just getting your assistant engaged with that as well, because,
one of my points.
Zepp's smacked... a certain league in Victoria a few times about foul counts being incorrect. So, if your assistant's charting that as well, and then, making sure that you as a staff know, but then also the player needs to know as well. Like, I've seen that too, where the head coach gets told, but then the player doesn't know, and then whack, now they've got four. Like, just understanding all those sorts of things can definitely help you win.
Yeah, absolutely. And you just got to know, the player's got to know how many fouls they've got. If they've got three, then you can't gamble on an offensive rebound contest next time down the floor at the start of the last quarter. Like, that hinders our chances to win the game. So, I think it's a really good one, mate.
I'm going next. Primary break.
Oh,
what number are we? 16. Primary break on the 16 into your secondary break. At a lot of levels, honestly, that's all you need. If you've got your first option in transition, that's taken away. Now you've got your second option. You can play the game at a higher level if you're using that sort of play. So putting that in place early, it goes again, should be an extension of your press breaker. How can we fall into this when we see pressure? We don't need to get the ball back to the top, stick it under our arm and call a play. The shot clock really matters now. So getting a good flow into your offense, understanding of what we're trying to teach, what we're trying to understand, when it's a lead post, when it's a drag screen, if it's an early ball screen, whatever it may be, but just having that drilled so that, again, you can keep the rhythm in your game.
I think that's a really valuable point. Like, you use the word flow there, and I have a lot of coaches contact me every week about, hey, I want to understand more about flow offense, and which is fine, like, no problem with that whatsoever, but I think the flow in transition sort of sums it up best. Like, you don't really want to have to run that as a set. You want to run that as a bunch of reads, and that flows through.
Yeah,
I think it's a great terminology for that as well.
I think the word flow is exactly that. Like, it's a loaded ball side handoff or ball screen action. Like, that's actually what it is. Flow is just what we call it because it flows. I think that's a really good thing. The 24 clock down here in Australia dictates a lot of this. So we watch a lot of college basketball on television, or we don't play with a shot clock up until a certain age. How important the 24-second clock is into having a primary and then a secondary is really huge, because you're going to end up rushing a shot or shoot a contested two if you don't take that into consideration. So shot clock determines a lot with that.
17. Zep, you're on.
Me? Yeah. You're both safe on this one as well. Baseline end line. So especially at a VJBL level, where maybe your preparation is, you know, 2 90-minute sessions a week with your club, having a set from the baseline where it will work against both a man and a zone is really handy. So whether it's a box set, a line set, whatever it is, if you've got something that you can call, this is red, and it works against both a man and a zone, then you're not really concerned with what the opposition is in, because against the zone, you know where to screen in the zone, you know where the gaps are in the zone. Against the man, you know who's cutting off where, who's the screener. So I think having a baseline, and really you can extend that to the sideline too. We can run a set that works both against the man and the zone from a sideline.
Yep, I think you get great value for money out of that, having something that will work against both, because I know there are plenty of coaches out there that will sit there and just religiously zone baseline, sideline, and not care.
Chula.
My,
say that.
My thing that I would throw out there, though, is maybe not just against man and zone, but having a two-point option and a three-point option. So what do we need here? It's 5 seconds to go, or, you know, 10 seconds to go, whatever it may be. Do we have a play that we've got a two-point option out of it and a three-point option out of it? So if you need it, you can go to it.
I've seen a couple of coaches have two different calls, and it's just odds and evens, and just depending on what the shot clock says. If it's 17, we're an odd. If it's 16, we're an even, and that's just what dictates what they run. So I think you can find a little cool little system like that as well.
Yep, excellent. I'm at 18. So mine is probably a little more philosophical rather than game-related. Make it a positive environment for your players to play and make it fun for them. Like, they want to come back, they want to be enjoying it. They don't need to be beaten with a stick constantly about...
Tell who's coached under 12 as well.
Holistic view. I need these players to still be playing in 8 years' time, otherwise I've done a terrible job. But there are different ways, and it is tough at times, like, because, and again, like, I do coach under 12s, like, 10-year-old kids make mistakes regularly, and regularly they'll make the same mistake, so you've got to be a little bit patient with it. But there's different ways you can package that as well. Like, it's you can deliver a really positive, then a negative, then a positive, that sort of sandwich method of coaching. It's like, hey, the effort's fantastic, but we've spoken about, you know, making that pass with your left hand 3 times now, and you keep making it with your right hand. Yeah. But, you know, when you go back in, that's all right. Just keep running on defense and we'll be all good. So you can package it up a little bit so they don't come out of there feeling like you've just given them a massive whack. Mm-hmm. But they can at least say, well, okay, there's something about this. And it is easy to get frustrated. It's easy to get frustrated with referees. Like, it's the same sort of thing. But, you know, one quote that I constantly got was, event plus response equals outcome. If you don't like the outcome and you can't change the event, change your response to it. I did have to read that off the paper because I always screw it up and I put something wrong somewhere. Right. But
I'm confused as shit, mate. That's...
Yeah, it's okay. It doesn't take a lot at times. Okay. Justin, your last one.
No, but extend on that real quick. That's a great point. I know we've spoken in pods of the past about that term, you know, like giving a spray or a serve, or it should be assertive instruction, not, you know, like, not making anything personal. And making an enjoyable environment, generally speaking, will determine whether you're able to win or lose, because the groups that have fun and it's an enjoyable thing, like, you can go as hard as you can in practice, but as long as it's an enjoyable environment, that generally breeds success. So that's a really good point, and one that should be at the forefront.
I did see another cool quote, Robbie. I can't remember who said it or exactly what they said. So,
Jake
Shaw? Nah, I don't think he would say something this good. But a coach was asked by a reporter, like, how did you think you did with this group of athletes? Like, did you get the most out of them? And his response was, speak to me in 20 years. Like, if them in 20 years' time, when they're working, when they're married, when they're doing their own thing, that's the product of, you know, the 12 months or 2 years that I spend with them. And that's maybe something that we lose sight of, is that you really do have such a profound impact on these young athletes.
Yeah. So I'm next with number 19.
3 to go.
Mine is zone offense. So you do need to plan for this, and obviously at certain age groups that you don't need to worry about zone at 12s and 14s in Victoria, but
I watch a lot of bar.
I know extended press zone, we've spoken about the press breaker, but you know, if you're going into tournament play, especially if you haven't prepped some form of zone offense, and doesn't mean to be need to mean that you play zone because you've got a zone offense, but you need to know what you're going to do against that. Have a plan, identify what the key areas that you believe in, we'll break that down, and just go through that, because I've seen a lot of seasons come unstuck by a team just throwing out a nice carnival zone, no idea what to do against it, and now you've lost the game. Too many times at national championships I've seen that. So have a plan against it, script it, work on it in practice, and get your athletes to understand what you're trying to achieve against it.
Beautiful. Number 20 for me, Robbie.
Yep.
Oh, very good. Last one from me. This is something I picked up in a really good book for the listeners. Bill Walsh, ex-San Francisco 49er head coach in the NFL. The score takes care of itself. He spoke about scripting. And what he said was that he would essentially script nearly the whole first quarter of the game out with his offensive calls from the sideline for the quarterback, directly based on what he saw on film from the opposition and tendencies, and you know how he thought the first quarter was going to play out. He thought it was revolutionary for him. And on the basketball side, I know there are a lot of coaches that do a very similar thing. I've heard Tom Izzo scripts the first seven plays of his games out. What it does give, it gives your athletes a little bit of clarity with how we're going to start the game. We're going to attack it for this reason, like we're going at them in the post because we want their post player in foul trouble. They're not a very good ball screen defense team, so we're going to put them in a lot of middle pick and roll. Where are you going to find your advantage early? You can't win the game in the first 4 minutes, but it certainly does help if you're up 10-4 at the first time out or 12-6. So I think scripting the first couple of sets, maybe at under 14 level, it's the first two plays of the game. Maybe as you get older, it's the first 4-6, under 18s, under 20s. But I think it's a good little thing. I used to end practice last couple of years, so Thursday night before the last part of practice, the last 2 minutes, 3 minutes, we would just script the first four plays, run the first four plays, finish with the main basket, and then go and hopefully execute them Saturday night. Robbie, I can tell you, it was some good scripting on Thursday, not such good scripting on Saturday.
So did it work in general then? Would you say it was worth it?
Yeah, we finished seventh last year. It worked really well.
Not a reflection on the coaching, I'm sure.
He was no good. Yeah, he was no good.
And the last one.
21, Robbie. Bring us home.
Again, it's a little bit more holistic necessarily than in-game. Treat all players fairly, but understand each individual is different. So you will need to coach every individual differently. Like, it's all well and good to have a set of rules for your team, but you do need to understand the athlete you're dealing with as well. Not every player can be treated the same way. Some players respond really well to positive feedback. Some are really good with negative. They are all going to be different, but you need to have a bit of a relationship with each player so that you can walk up to them and just have a conversation with them, because players don't like to feel threatened, obviously. If you can have a good relationship where you can walk up and you can talk about last week's game and they sit there and say, well, this is actually a good conversation for me to have. I don't feel like the coach is having a crack at me. I think you can get a lot out of it. And it will be a little different, I suppose. Like, the level of conversation I can have with my under 12s is very different to what I used to have with my under 18 boys last year.
Yep.
Like, my 18 boys used to talk about The Bachelor at training sessions. Like, my 12 boys are not capable of that at this point.
Where's the leadership in that program?
Yeah, I blame my assistant coach, in all honesty. Like, she had a lot more to do with it than I did. But that was just something that was a good relationship for them to have. So they felt that, well, okay, when they're talking to her, that's a really good thing. They didn't feel threatened by it. It was like, hey, this is just an extension of a coach, and it was easy.
I think what is clear from these 21 things, Robbie, that we've spoken about, is that you are definitely an under 12s coach this year.
Yeah, there is no absolutely question. There is no question.
I'll throw a 21.1 out there though. Just one thing that's kind of, we've got a lot of different angles on this, and a lot of it's content and X's and O's type chat, but the biggest influence I think we can have as coaches in any game is understanding the energy in the game. So one of the things that I see as a flaw in coaching is when you're up and about, when things are going well, and then things go bad and you sit down and you're on the sideline. Like, one of the things I've always believed for all coaches, with all this stuff that we've said, that stuff matters, but don't be seduced by the scoreboard. Understand, if the pressure goes up in the game, you need to be a little bit more controlled with your energy on the sideline. If it's flat out on the court, well, now you got to ramp that thing up, and that alone can be the difference between a couple points here and there by just controlling the anxiety or lifting the intensity.
Really good point. 21.2. I'll just piggyback that very, very, very quickly. The one thing that's really disappointing for mine, and this is just around the world watching basketball, the way a coach coaches the last 5 minutes down 20 when they've got athlete number 9, 10, and 11 in the game, says a lot. Why would you ever starve them of the development opportunity to make plays, to be in the right position, to execute at the end of the game? It's not their fault, or possibly is their fault, but they also deserve the same right to make plays and be coached. Like, I think that's, they deserve teaching and coaching as well. So I think making sure you're always teaching and always coaching and everything's always a development opportunity is really important.
Spot on, Zep.
21.3. No, I've got nothing else. We're done at 21. So hopefully that helps you guys with your coaching. You know, we might look at doing this again some other point down the road. If there's anything, say, hey, give us your 21 points on defense. Justin and I will have a great conversation. We might maybe sit outside for a little bit.
Yeah.
We'll see how we go.
Like Rock City's cheering is what's defense. But I think also this exercise is great for coaches to do and go, what are the 10 things that I think are going to make sure we have success on the floor?
Yeah.
And actually go through that. It's part of developing your philosophy and what you believe in the game. And I know way back when a coach told me, like, well, what are the 3 things in offense that matter to you? And it really got you thinking. Like, if you can spend some time on creating your own list, 21, 10, 2 things, you know, whatever it matters, and then that become the foundation of what you value as a coach, and extend that to your athletes, I think you're definitely along the path then of being able to be a good long-term coach.
Exactly right. And I think that's probably the idea of this podcast, is to be a little bit thought-provoking for other coaches out there. And I think you hit on a great point, is that, okay, well, here are our 21 that we came up with. Now go away and do some work on it yourself and find out exactly what you're about as a coach. And you may sit there and go, geez, I've only got 2. And it doesn't mean you're a bad coach. It just may need to put some more thought into it. And that's okay. Hopefully there's... provokes a little bit of that as well.
And the other thing, the last thing I'll say on that is my list has definitely changed over time. So the more experiences and scenarios and things like that, you kind of figure out what you really value, and there's nothing wrong with it changing. You know, like, it probably should change. You know, if you're staying the same as what you're doing from day dot of coaching, well, you're probably not progressive and not challenging yourself. But, you know, each year I'd be doing this exercise and just seeing what it is. You know, we do it without a doubt. Every year we're reviewing, and what works, what do I want to change, what do I believe?
For sure. Take us to a break, Robbie. Take us to a break.
Well, we are breaking into the split, the kick and the extra.
Oh, look out.
So for the split this week, we actually had a listener email into us.
Boom.
And say, hey, can you guys discuss this? Music at training sessions.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we're talking Barry Manilow, Dire Straits, that type of thing. Good or bad?
Do you reckon Robbie listens to that?
No, not at all. I was going through Barry. Mike's iPhone before and just happened to see this on Recently Play.
Right.
Justin, you are pro.
Finally, I'm pro.
You are pro music at training sessions.
Okay.
Good to go.
I'm starting. I'm not used to that. I'm always coming second because you make me the grumpy
Good
one.
Good luck, mate. Good luck.
Right. I am very pro about this, especially at certain parts of practice. So I'm not saying have music going the whole practice. Don't believe in that. But there are times where this can be a great thing to get the energy in the session going. We actually use it in warm-ups. So guys come into the change room, locker room, that's their time. They get to use whatever music they got going, that's their time. But then also when we get into the warm-up period with our physios, we want them to be feeling good about life. Puts them in a good headspace and also allows them to keep engaging with themselves. If you don't have it on, chances are they got their headphones in anyway and there's less interaction with their teammates. So I'm all for it. Bring it in, get the music going.
Excellent. Cranky Zep?
Robbie, is this a real question?
This is a real question. Okay, giving the people what they want.
I cannot believe this, but my colleague over there is off, completely off his rocker. Music at training, mate. Okay, let me just see the one day I roll into Killside practice and the music is pumping in the lead up to the Mount Gambier Saturday night game. I hope I see it. You brought up a point about music in the locker room. Yeah, put music in the locker room, not at practice. We can't have music on the practice floor. In the locker room, dance and party all you want to get yourself right, but that is fine. what are we doing? Dance training on the floor? A basketball team or dance team out on the floor? This is a basketball podcast. This is Blue. The people want us to talk about basketball, not dancing during practice. There's a teaching and learning environment where the coach is supposed to create the energy, not Dr. Dre, not Miley Cyrus, Robbie. The coach and the coaching staff are the ones to produce the energy in practice, and that is done with good coaching, not with iTunes. Robbie, I'll take the win, 7-0 for season 2.
I'd actually say it's the players that should create the energy, but you know, that's okay. Kick.
Good question. Yeah, people can keep sending their
I like when Zep's grumpy. Yeah, it's just enjoyable.
Fun. Unfortunately, we are going back to you on the kick, Justin.
No, this is probably one the every Perth fan's kicking, really. Great game of basketball, second semi-final, Perth Wildcats, Adelaide 36ers. PJ Togedo, been outstanding all year. One missed box out. Josh Childress gets the rebound, put back, and a foul. Gives Adelaide a chance to steal the game. Get a box out on that. Chances are Perth go down. They're in control and all over it. And it's the biggest thing that I see, especially as juniors really start taking a jump up a level, is understanding how important it is to hit a body first versus try and use your athleticism. No question, Tokido is probably the best athlete in the league. But in that moment in time, the fundamental matters more. And that, to me, is the kick. The missed box out probably cost Perth a chance to... Well, definitely cost them a chance to extend their season.
So are we going to spend the next 5 minutes just naming every player that's missed a box out and cost us a game over the years? I will say this.
When I saw that, I just thought of every game I've lost from a missed box out and like started cursing those people out. But, definitely. Fix that for me.
Yeah.
All right, man. All right. Extra. We good?
Oh.
The extra?
This is happy, Zep.
Well, we stuck the boot in a little bit last week, Robbie. we stuck the boot in a little bit.
The cease and desist has come in to BB and Zep is backtracking.
No, not backtracking. Things change. You can change your ways, Robbie, but really exciting to see. The press release went out yesterday or a couple of days ago, maybe now, about Melbourne United and the Olympic Park Trust offering High Sense Arena as a venue for some of our junior VJBL teams to play some games, play a couple of curtain raises before the playoffs, before the finals, use the venue during the week to play some games. So really great that they've come to the party on that and provided, what an opportunity. Like I never had the opportunity as a 13, 14-year-old to play an under-14 game at a 10,000-seat arena, but you know, the kids and the coaches and families must be pretty excited by that.
I think it's something that other sporting codes have done a great job of for a long time, is let young kids on the ground or floor where their heroes play. And I think it's Friday night games, yep, that's a reality of it. But to be able to give the athletes the access to play on Melbourne United's home floor, I think that's a buzz and a great thing for the sport here in Victoria.
Well, I mean, could it potentially be something that is looked at for all Friday night home games moving forward? Like, what a cool thing to have an under-18, under-16 game as a curtain raiser for an NBL game, WNBL games. Like, I know the seasons maybe don't cross over a majority of them, but what an opportunity. AFL's done it historically, under-19 games, reserve games, leading into senior games.
I think it's a great idea and great point, and it just probably requires a couple of people to put their heads together and make it happen, but... it's a great thing.
Robbie's
for
put
the,
his hand up. Well, I don't know,
great thing for the sport, and a huge thing for the sport here in Victoria, that we're going to have maximum three games at home here in Melbourne. Get along.
Get on board. Robbie, really good podcast today, mate. You did well.
Oh, thanks very much. I appreciate the feedback. It's very rare we get that from you. It's sort of thrown me a little bit. I'm not used to getting the positive feedback from Zep.
Well, you've lifted, like, mate. You've lifted. That's all we're saying.
Took you two seasons, mate, but you knew it.
Eventually. Yeah. You know, I just appreciate you guys just rolling in here and buggering off and leaving me to do all the editing. That's fantastic. You know, it's really appreciated on my end, especially when Justin just continues to swear. He's doing everything he can to get us that little red E on the podcast.
Did I swear again?
Yeah, you're pretty good, dropped setup. It. Might have been in the end. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, might
be. Hey, so last one next week.
Last one next week.
Last episode before we take a bit of a break.
Mailbag next week.
So
we have had a whole heap of coaches email in over the last couple of weeks and say, hey, look, can you discuss this? And it probably hasn't been enough individually for an entire podcast.
Yeah.
But it is worth us sort of touching on as well. So,
send some more in. We want to be able to get that done next week and max it out.
Awesome.
It would be fantastic. Same as always, iTunes, Audio Boom, BV website. Mm-hmm. You can download the podcast. Please like, share, retweet, and try and get the word out there as much as you can. Hashtag Talking Split. You can get Justin and I on Twitter. Mike, Carrier Pigeon. Best of luck if you can try and get him on that. Probably just one other thing. Do check out the BA Coaches Conference that's coming up in May up in Canberra. You can get all the details out on coach.basketball.net.au to register, and as well as the BV resources page. So there's a few videos on there from various clinics that we've had in Victoria over the course. I think you're on there a couple of times, Justin.
Possibly, yeah, I'm not sure.
That's always reassuring.
I've done a few clinics, yeah. So there's definitely stuff out there.
So you can get that on basketballvictoria.com.au/coaching-resources/.
That's backslash or backslash, Robbie?
Look, just type in Basketball Victoria. Follow the links for there and you'll be able to get a hold of the videos.
You're copying backslash.
It's not bad. Thanks everyone for listening. I don't know how we got through this one. It's deteriorated fairly rapidly in the last couple of minutes. But
let's get out.
Wrap it up.
Thanks everyone. Good luck with your coaching. We'll catch you guys next week.
See you, mate.